But I have to ask, while we're waiting here, how many of you are experts in slugs and snails?
I like beer.
See, and already I have an advantage. Already I have an advantage
right.
over hell.
But doesn't the beer kill them?
Kills us too.
Because you're gonna have to believe it.
Right.
Doesn't stop us from drinking it though.
No.
The banana slug is the mascot of Santa Cruz.
That's right.
Really?
That's right.
The kids at camp said if you lick the slug, it makes your mouth go to sleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jeez.
Jeez.
You did it. It didn't work.
See,
then
you practically are an expert.
And I have to say, the motto of the University of California at Santa Cruz is
"Do like beer."
Slug.
And
is what?
I don't like
Fiat
beer.
Oh, slug. Okay. Let there be slugs.
Well, I never did like them.
And then
kids
Evergreen
so.
State is
the gooey dog.
And
their mascot motto is "Omnia Exstaris," which means "Let it all hang out."
I love that.
Cut that out this morning. It's true.
That's
about
right.
I'm struggling.
Well, I'm going to get started a minute early.
Good.
So I can go a minute over and we'll be right on time. I wanted to tell you, my name is David George Gordon. And I was talking about this at lunch today. I believe it's my mission to sing the praises of nature. That's my religion, basically. And I learned this from a gentleman. I was actually attending a workshop, and he was telling us about what he had studied with the Ainu people of Japan. Those are the equivalent of the Northwest Coast natives that actually occupied Japan before they were supplanted by people from the mainland. So they're the original people of Japan. They're salmon culture, just like Northwest Coast people. And this person told my friend that that's why we're here on Earth. That nature basically can do everything by itself except sing its praises. So I thought, when I heard that, I thought, this is really amazing because that's kind of what I've been doing ever since I was quite small, in extolling why things are wonderful in the natural world. That's what I do for a living. That's what I did for a hobby, and that's what I did when I was a little kid. So when I heard that, it made a lot of sense to me. So bear with me while I sing the praises of nature in three different forms this week. We're going to talk about slugs and snails and my love of invertebrates. We're going to talk about edible insects, and we're also going to talk about the Sasquatch. And I know we have at least one good Sasquatch expert here, right here at the camp. So that should be an interesting one. And we're not going to do any reading alone. So I put this picture up first because we as a group collectively have very ambivalent feelings about invertebrates. The very name itself is weird. I mean, we're talking about animals without backbones. That's what an invertebrate is. That's 90% of life on our planet. We have backbones. We're calling the shots, so we're the vertebrates, and everybody else is something else, 90% of the planet. That's kind of weird when you think about it. It's like if catfish ordered the entire world as non-catfish and catfish. Right? But also we really need invertebrates. Invertebrates basically make the world go round. If we didn't have insects, for example, I think our entire ecosystem would collapse within a month. We need pollinators, we need food for other animals, we need decomposers, all these really important roles. But you know, for most of us, you talk about bugs, we're talking about swatting them. They're a nuisance. What good are they? The mollusks and snails and slugs are in this very large group of animals called mollusks. So are clams and oysters and all these other critters. We need them for lots of purposes. In fact, the gooey duck, and this picture is greatly exaggerated, they do get pretty big, and they're pretty unusual. The gooey duck industry right now is a multi-million dollar industry exporting these to Asian countries, where they're considered a great delicacy. Clams and oysters. Washington State actually runs the United States. We're actually the largest producer of clams and oysters in the United States, and probably third or fourth in the world. So we have weird feelings about, and for that matter, most people don't really know much about these guys, that 90% other than they're out there. We know a lot about horses, about dogs and cats, and so on, but I bet we'd be hard-pressed to have a very long conversation about, oh, I don't know, flatworms. Some of us probably even have flatworms.
Okay. Let's not talk about that.
But we won't go there right now. We don't keep them as pets. Let's put it that way. Here's my book. It's called The Secret World of Slugs and Snails, Life in the Very Slow Lane. And my wife, Karen, did all the illustrations for this book. So when you see black and white illustrations in here, that would be Karen. Has contributed them. She's actually going to be holding court in the crafts cave, is that what it's called? Mm-hmm. This evening at 7:30, so right after Vespers, if you want to come and draw like Karen, you can come down here and draw.
No.
Draw like yourself with Karen's expert assistance. So I call this book Life in the Very Slow Lane because I was fascinated with the fact that, of course, slugs and snails do everything slowly. And we value speed. As primates, we think things have to be faster and faster and faster. You know, and actually there's now a movement for slow food. Of course, their logo is a snail. There's even slow travel as well. People are starting to appreciate that, you know, the superhighway isn't always where it's at. You can get a lot more by taking a side road and stopping and smelling the roses. So the whole notion of a critter that really has made its entire life and does just fine with doing everything slowly. It was fascinating to me. When you come right down to it, slugs and snails do everything very differently than us, than primates. They are cold-blooded, we're warm-blooded. They have green blood instead of red blood. It's based on copper, appropriate for here. Parental involvement. Forget that, they lay their eggs and then everybody's off on their own. All these things that we like to consider secrets of success for our culture. Opposable thumbs, you've probably all heard about that, you know, a lot of those to grip tools. They don't have opposable thumbs. They don't have hands or arms for that matter, no limbs at all. Kind of amazing how different they are than us. But they're nonetheless just as successful. And if any of you are gardeners outside of this immediate area, you know how successful they can be. They're almost impossible to get rid of. Oh, one more thing. We like to think that we have these enormous brains, the central processing unit that makes us who we are today. It even determines at what stage our infants are born, so we can have those nice big heads. These guys have like a ring of six nerve cells that call the shots. That's it. And they do just fine that way. So one of the things I want to start out with is we're now looking at something that for all our intents and purposes is like looking at life on Mars. Very different than ourselves, but very much a part of our environment. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. I also always like to talk about the human connections. Whenever I write a book, and I've written a bunch of them, everything from gray whales and orca whales all the way down to cockroaches and snails and slugs, I really like to focus on that human element. And two things. One is this big question that always comes up, well, what good are slugs and snails? And one of those, of course, is easy to answer. For starters, we're really talking about what good are slugs and snails to us. We're not looking at the bigger picture of things. I mean, in the bigger picture, they are decomposers, they're pollinators, they're food for other animals. They have a real niche. My favorite thing is this quote, and I have it in my book. When I worked on this book, I worked with a gentleman named Barry Roth. He's a West Coast go-to guy on slugs and snails, lives in San Francisco, and he told me the story, which I put in the book, about a student of his who was actually studying in the seminary and got really interested in malacology. That's the science of soft-bodied animals like slugs and snails. And his parents were furious when he announced that he was leaving the seminar.
the seminary to become a malacologist. They're like, why are you doing this? And he said, what's so special about slugs and snails? And this guy said, well, they're God's way of showing us that not everyone can be an eagle. So that's also playing into my theme for tonight, which is that we're dealing with creatures that are way different from us, but there are lots of lessons we can learn from them as well. This picture, by the way, is a Dr. Mead. He was around in the early 1700s in England. This is the only thing I'm going to read from my book, because I like this. It's almost a poem. Dr. Mead was working in the hospital in England. This is, of course, before they had figured out where germs came from or how to treat them with antibiotics. He came up with this amazing sanitary procedure, which was washing everything down in the hospital with snail water. Sounds delicious, doesn't it? I'm going to read you his recipe for snail water. And no, I'm not drinking it. Okay, this is where I think this sounds like poetry to me. Take garden snails, cleansed and bruised, 6 gallons. Earthworms, washed and bruised, 3 gallons. We're talking about a lot of stuff here, aren't we? Of common wormwood, round ivy, and cardus, each 1.5 pounds. Pennyroyal, juniper berries, fennel seed, aniseeds, each 0.5 pounds. Cloves and cubebs bruised, each 3 ounces. Spirit of wine and spring water of each 8 gallons.
That's the best part so far.
That's right. Digest them together for the space of 24 hours and then draw it off in a common alembic. You know, alembic is like a still, basically. So that was going to ward off all sorts of diseases in this hospital. I can't really tell you whether it worked or not because I wasn't there. Yeah. Okay, now I've done my part by reading from my book, Boosting Book Sales. This is a moon snail, one of Karen's drawings. A lot of us are familiar with marine snails. You go out low tide, you're going to see some of these guys. Or maybe you see that what they leave behind are little egg cases that are actually, they look like little rubber gaskets almost. They're quite large. All that blobby stuff fits into the shell at low tide. These are marine snails. They actually breathe water. They breathe air from water through gills, just like fish would. So they're actually happiest when they're submerged, but they can survive for long periods of low tides out there. They just stop breathing, basically, for that period and kind of go into a torpor. But we're not talking about marine snails. We're actually talking about land slugs and snails. And I'm using this is a generic slug illustration, just so you can see it. Think of slugs basically as snails without shells. So it's a lot easier to see their parts than it would be if you're looking at the snail. I've always thought this is funny that, you know, slug, well, the very name rhymes with ug, right? They're kind of gross. Are we all in agreement on that? Okay. If you put a shell on one, now they're adorable. And I see children's toys that are made of snail shells. Characters in cartoons that are adorable, but this is not adorable. But I want to point out a few things. So first of all, is this nice little black hole right there. That's actually an opening called a pneumostone. Use that word in Scrabble sometime. It's actually where the air comes in. These guys have lungs. They don't have gills. And they have one lung. If you see that hole, it's on the right-handed side. If they had hands, it would be on the right side of this creature. They don't have another one on the left side. You know, we like to think we're bilaterally symmetrical. We have a right side, left side, same difference. These are not symmetrical in that way. But inside of that hole is a lung that's actually about as complicated as a salamander's lung. This is pretty unusual for an invertebrate. And it's an adaptation that they actually have developed so that they can live on land wholly and without ever getting into water. Now, we do find freshwater snails. I bet there are some in this creek here. But these actually are wholly terrestrial. They live on land and get by just fine. That mantle, that's that area there that the hole is centered in, is actually what would be the place where this creature would be secreting its shell. It's like a gland that secretes calcium. And if it were a snail, that would be where this, the shell would be coming from in layers. It's kind of interesting because there are creatures, I love this term, called semi-slugs that have a really little bit of a shell left. It's a vestigial bit of that shell, about the size of my pinky fingernail, let's say. Nothing to climb into. They also have a foot. I mentioned before they don't have limbs. This whole notion of what the scientific term for these gastropods, that means they're stomach feet. That's what that means in scientific terms. And they actually crawl across the ground using contractions of that foot. If you put one on a piece of glass and look up at it, you can actually see the contractions. It's like a really psychedelic experience to see these little bands of contraction. And of course, they also produce slime. If you think about it, those slime glands are all over its body, but they're actually surfing on a wave of slime with those contractions and by laying down that slime. In my book, I have 7 wonders of snaildom, one of them being slime, of course, one of them being speed or lack thereof. But there's lots to be said about slime, and I'm only going to say a little about it, so we can talk about it over dinner. The one thing I love about slime production is, if you think about it, you know, I remember reading a joke, it probably was in Boys Life magazine, a kid saying to his teacher, and the teacher saying, "Why were you late to school?" "Well, it was so slick outside because of the ice, every step I took 2 steps backwards." And the teacher said, "Well, how'd you get here at all?" And the kid says, "Well, I turned around." So how do these guys get along if they're producing this slippery stuff? How do they ever go uphill? Well, they can actually adjust the slime to be extra sticky or slippery, depending on what they need. Don't you wish you could do that? Kind of amazing. Okay, it turns out it's actually the slime itself is a polymer. It's a fascinating material, and if they put a lot of pressure on it, it gets stickier. So that's why you can actually see slugs and snails climbing up walls. I've actually seen them on the ceiling of a cabin I stayed in one time. They can get all over the place. Okay, getting down to the real details, you can see they have what people would commonly call horns or antennae. Those are actually optic stalks. Those 2 big ones have little eyes on them. They have eyes that are complex. They're not compound eyes like on bugs. They actually have little lenses in them so they can see things. And I've seen them look at me while I'm looking at them. It's kind of a fascinating thing. But they also have these little smaller ones called sensory tentacles. Those actually are the equivalent of the slug or the snail's nose. And they use those for sniffing. Because getting back to the slime for a moment, they can actually put chemical messages in the slime. Sounds like Valentine's Day to me. Now those messages might say, "Follow me, I know where there's some great broccoli." Or they might say, "You know, stay out of this side of the garden, this is my territory." But other slugs can actually follow, or snails, can actually follow those slime trails. Charles Darwin wrote about this. I'm not making it up. That they can actually sort of lead each other into the good stuff or away from the good stuff they want. Now the last thing you can't really see here, there's a little arrow there, the genital opening. I mentioned this morning these are hermaphrodites. Most of their genitalia is actually enclosed inside, but when it comes out, it's whopping. I have to tell you, I wrote an earlier book where I said that I thought that slugs had disproportionately large sex organs. And this nice professor emeritus at the University of Washington said, "Compared to what?" But sometimes you'll actually see, and there's a drawing in here later, you'll see when they're actually coupled, because that's a very involved process. There's both exchanges of both genetic material, both sperm and eggs. It's a 2-way trade. When the genitalia are all hooked up, it's a complicated thing. It almost looks like there's a third animal in the process there. What is that thing anyway? So, enough for the basic biology here. I've always thought this would make a great shower curtain. These are Northwest slugs, both native and non-native. One of the things I really want to emphasize today is that the slugs and snails that we battle with in our gardens, especially if they live in Western Washington or any of these wetter areas, those are mostly non-native slugs or snails. They've been brought here by accident, usually in potted material, and have a wonderful time. They've left all their enemies home in the old country, so they don't have to worry about being swallowed whole.
So the ones that I mostly see in Bellingham, Washington, are like the all black ones or the brown ones?
Yeah, boo hiss. Those are native, non-natives, and we don't like them. They also give the native slugs and snails a hard time. So the ones that actually belong here are oftentimes attacked by the non-natives. I love saying this because I'm not a native of Washington State. So I'm sure there are natives that feel exactly the same way.
We'll be attacking you later.
That's right. But the one that most people are familiar with as a native is the banana slug. That's the one at the very bottom here. These guys are quite impressive. They can actually get to be about 10 inches long and weigh a quarter of a pound.
Whoa.
I know. Not bad for an animal with no bones in its body. That's a lot of weight there. The one directly above it with all the nice little spots on it, you can see that one right there. That's a non-native called Limax maximus. I love Latin names, so that's a very, sounds like a Roman gladiator to me. Limax maximus! It's called the giant garden slug. People also call these leopard slugs. They're not native to this area. I'll show some pictures in a little bit. They're actually, I have a whole bunch of really nice color photographs, but I do like this whole conceit here of having all these different guys in one picture.
David, is there a jumping slug on the last slide?
The warty
jumping slug, and you know, I'm going to talk about that guy in just a minute. There is method to my madness. Okay. Now, aren't you beginning to think, gee, these are really neat, I wish I could get one? Probably not. Okay, now we're getting to the cute guys here.
Because they have shells.
Because they have shells. These are all the different native and non-native species. We're kind of blessed with slugs and snails in Washington, the evergreen state. I've often thought it should be the state invertebrate. But you all laugh. I have to tell you, there is a state invertebrate, and it's the green darner dragonfly. Could have been the banana slugs. Okay, this also has a mixture of natives and non-natives, and we'll look at some photographs of these as we get further along. But this one I like to point out, this is one in the bottom corner there called a brown garden snail. Lots of people have these. When I lived in Port Townsend, they were all over the place. Turns out there's a real advantage to being a snail. You can go inside your shell. A slug cannot do that. And if it gets really dry, they go inside their shell, they equivalent of hibernate, called estivating. They go to sleep in there.
They have like a little door they can pull up too, right?
Exactly. And actually, these don't pull up a door, they make a little door out of, guess what?
They're slime.
Slime, exactly. Or mucus, as we like to say. So they can stay inside of there for quite a long time. And different species, actually, there are species that actually live in the desert and remain in this torpid state, all sealed up for years at a time.
Until it rains?
Yeah, and then it rains, or the humidity gets to a high enough point, they come out and have a good time. I actually wrote about this in my book, but there was this one snail that was on display at the British Museum in London, and it was actually glued to a little card in a glass case, and after 6 years, the humidity rose and it woke up.
Oh, no.
Start crawling around someone, so the night guard said, that card is moving. Amazing. But anyway, getting back to the brown garden snail, these are non-native. They're actually supposedly brought here in the 1800s by a gentleman who owned a vineyard in San Jose, California. And he was importing all these grape stocks from France. And he thought, what this country needs is a good escargot snail. Because that's what these are. They're one of two different species commonly eaten as escargot. Escargot, while we know we associated with France, of course, was actually very popular with the Romans. It was the Italians who actually got us onto eating escargot. How many of you have eaten escargot before? What did it taste like?
No, but it's earthy.
You know what I think is funny is most people say it tastes like garlic butter. Too much seasoning. I want them to be able to say, it tasted sort of like a banana slug, only a little more piquant. All right. I'm going to show some actual color photographs of some of these in a little bit, so I'm going to jump over this picture. Okay. When Karen drew this picture originally and submitted it to the publisher, they went, oh, too fanciful, not knowing that this picture was drawn from a photograph. These are two of those escargot snails. They're about to get down to the act of making more snails. And I've mentioned before, everything they do is slow. Courtship can take days. They actually will circle each other. There's all sorts of theories on why this is. Some people say it's so they, by having really elaborate courtships, they're less likely to interbreed among species. And it's kind of like, you gotta know the dance steps if you're gonna get into this act here. And what they're doing right now is they're actually touching the bottom of their sole where they have lots of nerve cells and kissing.
Aww.
Aww. That's right, it's the Valentine's slug. I mean snail, excuse me. So of course this is all a prelude to actually getting it on, and that can take days. Now I mentioned that there's this whole thing of swapping eggs and sperm, and there's lots of strategies in nature. You know, the real prime directive of nature is to pass your chromosomes on to the next generation. Sad but true, that's what in biology most people think is why we're all here, to share the wonders of our flat-footedness or whatever with another generation. So you would think that in a trade like this, it would be an even 50-50 swap. You know, eggs and sperm are going in both directions. It turns out there are all sorts of strategies for having the upper hand, the trade monopoly in this. And the one I absolutely love is snails have this thing called a copulatory dart. They actually shoot a dart at each other. It's this little piece, it looks like a little splinter, and it's made out of calcium. It's kept in a little dart pouch, kind of like you keep arrows in them. Some people think this is actually where the idea of the Cupid came from. They say, well, the ancient Greeks clearly knew about this copulatory dart. Why else would they have a little guy shooting people with an arrow to make them fall in love? For years, no one could really figure out what the purpose of this whole thing was. They found out later, as technology has got more sophisticated, that copulatory dart actually has little chemicals on it, pheromones, that actually make the one who's been shot more receptive to the sperm of the other one. So if you're shooting first, your chances of passing your genes on direct hit are a little better than if you did not. I read an article about this, by the way, in a Canadian newspaper. You know, Canadians love hockey. So their headline was, "He shoots, she scores." If you see me during dinner or later tomorrow, ask me about how slugs do this. Because are there children in the audience? That's getting too randy for this program. Yes, I talk about this in my book. There's the genitals mingling in this picture. These are two of those leopard slugs. And they're mating in midair, suspended by a thread of...
Slime!
Slime! That's right. I say this is the Cirque du Soleil of slug sex.
Is this
kind of amazing? And actually, periodically, you know, I get really great emails. Some people just say, I was out on my deck and I saw this. What is it? I'm like, quit sending me your dirty pictures. Okay, of course, after all of this shenanigans, a few months go by, and then these fertile eggs are laid. The planning usually is to lay eggs in the fall. They're right under the leaf litter in a little hole, or maybe in the leaf litter, and they winter over and hatch in the spring. That's the maximum time for this time frame. The eggs are small, if you've ever seen them, or they're really recognizable. They have hard shells like chicken eggs. They're about the size of little tapioca grains, depending on the species and how big those are. And again, there's no parental involvement whatsoever. You know, our secret of success, they do fine without it. A hint is that, oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
What are they doing while they're not
birthing?
Well, they're out eating.
No, the eggs. Are they evolving?
Yeah, there's a little embryo in there, and actually, by the time they hatch out, they look like mom and dad, only they're teeny.
Okay. So they actually have a shell.
Yes.
When they were.
I had banana slugs for pets for a little while. Chiquita and Dole. And they were—I couldn't tell the difference between the two. I didn't know. They had babies in this little terrarium they had set up, and the babies looked adorable. They were just like mom and dad, only about this big.
Oh,
I let them loose. It was like born free. Okay, so one of the practical tips, and yes, there are going to be practical tips in this talk. If you really are concerned about slugs and snails, you live in Western Washington where it's moist and they get by here. I believe here it's a little too cold in the winter for most slugs to survive, or snails, even with this whole notion of getting in under that insulating layer of leaf litter. But if you really want to get rid of your slugs and snails, wait until early spring and then start raking up that leaf litter on your property and exposing those eggs to the air, which does not do them any favors, but even more so to birds and other animals which love to eat them. So, sneaky trick there without using chemicals.
Don't you feel bad about that since you had them as pets? Aren't you like giving them?
Well, I'll tell you, I feel bad about the native species and I don't have any mercy at all about the non-native species. And like I said, most of our struggles are with non-native species. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about it, the native species grew up to live in our old-growth forests. Mm-hmm. There's studies that show banana slugs, they actually eat like 40 different kinds of plants and fungi and anything else they find. These guys grew up and evolved in the same countries, in the same regions, where most of our garden crops came from. Mm-hmm. You know, broccoli is not native to North America. So they know exactly what that is and they go for it. Whereas I think a banana slug would be going, kind of, what am I doing here? Where are all my friends? So they're much more detrimental to people who are gardening, the non-native species. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Here's that Helix, the escargot snail. These pictures are all taken by British Columbian woman Christina Ovaska. And I think they're kind of right up there with the Audubon bird shots. There's some really good ones in here. We talked about this one a little bit. Here's our other very common non-native. This is a Sepia nemoralis. It's also called a grove snail. And these can be such a problem. They get their name because they actually will eat an orange grove. Yeah, they really run amok. They love citrus. And they actually started introducing a cannibalistic snail, another species. You can actually get a permit, apply for a permit, get these snails, let them loose on your orange grove. They go after these snails and wipe them out.
Wow.
Biological control. Yeah?
Are the cannibalistic snails, are those a native species? Or is it sort of like a cane toad situation where you bring them in and it's like...
Yeah, the ones they use in groves, I think what you're referring to is the ones they use in groves are non-native, but you actually have to apply for a permit for those.
Okay.
I mean, it's like very regulated.
Okay.
There's been a really long history of, I've got an idea, why don't we introduce this animal?
Yeah.
That'll get rid of them. We'll just bring out some snakes or whatever.
And
yeah, then they have all sorts of problems. Cane toads, it turns out, were active during the... They're supposed to be eating the bugs that eat cane plants, which were active by day, and the cane toads were active at night. And now they have this enormous problem of getting rid of cane toads. But in just a little bit, I'm going to show you a native species that actually belongs here and goes after other snails and wipes them out. And that's a good thing. These, by the way, you notice the bands on their shells? There's actually a study, you can go online and see this. I think the Royal British Museum did this study. It turns out those bands are camouflage. So where they really want to hide, they have really distinctive bands. And you see all different kinds of patterns, you know, depending on how much they want to hide. Some don't have bands at all. So there's a website where you can go and click on what your snails look like. You know, no bands, dark bands, kind of in between. What they're basically doing is they're mapping where the predators of these guys are. because there's a thrush, a kind of a bird, that really goes after these. And they actually use, I love this, it's a very British term, thrush anvils. These are rocks that the thrushes will pick up a snail, bash its shell, break it, and you'll find a rock with all these shells all around it. They're using that to break open the shells. Well, places where they have no bands at all, that means no thrushes. They don't have to hide. So they're getting a great database of where the thrushes actually exist by having people report the snails. Cool project. This is one of our Northwest natives. It's called the Pacific Sideband. They're pretty large. And they actually, I know this photograph in this light is not doing it justice, but they have a really rich sort of mahogany shell, colored shell. Yeah, there we go. Oh, that helps some. The thing that's so wonderful about these guys, they oftentimes aren't seen by us because they live way up in the forest canopy. They can be like 100 feet off the ground. Living in those crotches of those really big leaf maple trees where there's lots of moss and all sorts of leaf litter and stuff. So they spend their entire existence way up there. We hardly ever see them. And you know, I mentioned just a moment ago that there are actually native species that are, I would say, carnivorous and actually chase down, if you can imagine that, other snails. This one is called a robust lance tooth. One of the things I didn't mention earlier, and probably should have, is that these guys, in order to eat, they actually have teeth on a tongue. It's called a radula, and it actually serves like a file. If you're actually in a really quiet room with a snail, you can hear it eating. Kind of neat. And that's because they're scraping away at whatever they're eating with this radula. Well, these particular guys have on their radula, they have teeth that are actually specially modified. They're like harpoons. And they also, as you can see, can come very far out of the shell. So they can follow another shell back as it's retreating, running away into its shell. They can follow it right into the shell, nab it with those special teeth, pull it out of the shell, and eat it.
Oh, wow. That did
the other guy. Yeah. You know, kind of amazing. And I always wondered when I lived on a little property in Seattle where we had lots of hostas, which you would think snails and slugs love to eat, but not many problems. Well, it was a streamside piece of property, and there were lots of these snails there. I'm kind of convinced they were doing a great job of controlling things. So I guess I bring this up because it does pay to know the difference between natives and non-natives and not just go walking around stomping on everything indiscriminately. Here's that bad guy, the leopard slug. And like I said, these also chase other slugs, bite them, and leave them to die. So sometimes if you go out and you see a slug kind of gasping its last gasp on the sidewalk, the sun has come up, they should be hiding. They've probably had an altercation with a leopard slug. Bummer. Here's our friend the banana slug. We've already talked a little earlier about how this is the mascot of the University of California at Santa Cruz.
That's the fighting slug. The kids love to lick. Is that true? If they lick it, does it make your...
You know, I've never licked a slug, but I've been told that that is something that people do in Boy Scout camps and things like that, because it has an anesthetic property. I don't recommend it. Partly because we talked about flatworms before. Sometimes they do have parasitic worms. We don't want those.
So is that its lung on the right there?
That's right. And this are like half closed. It's in mid-gasp right there. Beautiful photograph. Now, these come in all different colors. You can see yellow ones. You can see yellow ones with black spots that kind of look like ripe bananas, green ones, brown ones. I've seen ones from Tatoosh Island way up north, northwesternmost point of Washington, which is cold all the time. They're black. They actually absorb heat that way. And it turns out the different color patterns oftentimes reflect how much heat absorption they have to do during the day to get up and get going. The thing I find most fascinating about banana slugs, they did a study about this, that, you know, I mentioned before, they eat like 40-some different kinds of plants. Well, in the redwoods of California, their range extends all the way south to northern California and all the way north into southeast Alaska, or southwest Alaska, rather. And in the redwood forest, they actually will eat all the little stuff that's growing around redwood seedlings. They're actually gardening and giving their seedlings an advantage rather than having something grow over it and overshadow it. And of course, when they poop, they're leaving fertilizer for that very seedling. So then if you drive down to see the redwoods and they're towering trees, you can know with confidence that they actually got their start thanks to banana slugs. I know. Hooray for them.
They're heroes.
That's right. And they make good pets. This is called a tail dropper. You'll be able to see a better picture of one in just a second. This is a lovely purple slug. And these guys have an adaptation where they actually will drop the little bit of their tail if they're being chased by a predator. Like, you know those black beetles you sometimes see when you're gardening? Those are predatory beetles called carabid beetles. They like to eat smaller slugs. And if they drop a little bit of the tail, it's like lizards do this too. They're hoping that that carabid beetle or whomever is chasing after them will be happy with that and leave them so they can live to fight another day. Did I hear someone say warty jumping slug?
Yes.
Because that's what this is. These actually, in order to avoid predators, rock back and forth and leap. And if you look at them really closely, you can see on that mantle, that's that like saddle-like effect on its back. There are bumps all over it. But I always think warty jumping slug sounds like something from Harry Potter. A lot of these jumping slugs, by the way, are endangered or threatened, and they're on the you know, we like to focus on the panda or the Bengal tiger or these really charismatic, what they call charismatic megafauna. It turns out that a lot of the smaller critters in the world are actually way more endangered than they are. Mostly because habitat destruction, they're very bound to a specific habitat type or a specific plant. There are lots of butterflies that have become extinct in my lifetime because their plants have been plowed under for housing developments.
How far can they jump?
You know, I've never actually seen one, but I'm told that they can jump about 2 inches.
Like jump up or jump sideways?
I'm saying sideways 2 inches.
In
or
my
forward
imagination,
two inches.
They jump much
higher. When you're a 2-inch long slug, jumping 2 inches is long. Furthermore, I'm sure it was ever the predator went, I didn't know they could jump. And they're gone. Good trick. Okay, now that I've told you how wonderful slugs and snails are, I feel obligated to tell you how to get rid of them. This is not the way to go, a leg hold trap. I think I bought this at Ye Olde Curiosity Shop. But there are lots of ways to go that don't involve poisoning the earth with pesticides or herbicides or any of these noxious chemicals. Slug bait, for the most part, is not a pretty thing. So I'm going to run down really quickly, because I know I'm running out of time, a few ways of keeping slugs and snails under control in your garden. I don't think you'll ever get rid of them, but you could forge a meaningful and lasting peace with them. The first thing you can really do is modify the way you garden. And this picture, also drawn by Karen, has some do's and don'ts in it. For starters, you can see in the upper left corner there's a big compost bin. Well, slugs and snails like eat dead stuff. Compost creates warmth. It's kind of like fighting the Vietnam War and having the enemy coming in from Cambodia. That you're constantly getting new recruits from your compost. If you move that back a little bit, you'd have a better chance of getting rid of them. The same thing is true with the wood pile that's stacked back there. That's just giving them lots of hiding places where they can hang out, reproduce, and come back onto your garden. So that's not a good thing. Move that further back. A good thing, though, is this nice path going through here. Now, slugs and snails have so many little muscles in their feet that they can actually crawl across crushed glass. And actually, at one time, tried having one crawl across a razor blade. Because I'd read about this. And yes, he got about halfway across, turned around and came back over the same blade. So it didn't bother this slug in the slightest.
Was that Dole, or was that one of your slugs?
Oh, I thought maybe it was what you were saying. Was it a dull razor blade?
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, it was Dole. I was actually kind of worried. What if this is just an old wife's tail? any rate, what it really does, though, is that a little gravel path like that dries out faster. And slugs and snails are very wary of wasting moisture. It takes a lot of water to produce slime. So they are always conserving moisture. If there's a dry area, they'll avoid it. This is, of course, another thing. Don't overwater your gardens and give them a chance to have fun. A lot of people water their gardens at night. I think we've all been taught, well, anyway, that way the water seeps in, doesn't evaporate. Well, it's kind of like running the Zamboni before a hockey game. It's really setting conditions for nocturnal animals like slugs and snails. Oh, it's nice, nice and moist, come out, come out. And that can be a problem. So water your gardens early in the morning. Spend that quality time in your garden early before you go off to work rather than at night when you come home. There are traps that you can make. This is a beer trap. You cut a little curtain like this, you put windows in it, you bury it at soil level, and you put a little bit of beer in there. It turns out the slugs and snails are really attracted to the yeast in beer. You know, there's been a study on just about everything in the world. Someone in Colorado actually did a study on which beer do they like the best. It turns out they don't like the microbrews. I mean, it doesn't really matter to them. PBR is fine, Pabst Blue Ribbon is fine. What they really liked the most was a non-alcoholic beer, Kingsbury malt beverage, because it had more yeast in it. So you can sort of sweeten the deal and add brewer's yeast into that. What happens is the slugs or the snails get into there, and they drown. They basically start absorbing all of this moisture until they can't take it anymore. It's basically the way I want to go in life is drown in Nevada beer. And I always tell people, because slugs and snails do like to eat dead stuff, don't take the dead ones out of there too soon. Because now we go, beer-soaked slugs. And they actually come in even more to that. Here's a biological control. These are guinea fowl. You know, people put ducks and chickens out into their yards. They go scratching around, and they'll eat slugs and snails, too. The problem is all that scratching and pecking that they do is actually destructive to gardens, too. Well, it turns out guinea fowl are a little less destructive that way. And I remember going to the herb farm outside of Seattle one time, and as soon as you pulled up in your car, a whole flock of these guys would come running over. They were basically using them for biological control. It's hard to convince people, but if you have snakes in your yard, that could be a good thing, because they also eat slugs and snails. So do frogs and toads. So do lots of birds. So there's lots of biological opportunities there, too. I always say use the pesticides as a, or molluscicides in this case, as a last resort. There's sometimes when you just can't get the upper hand without them. And I'm happy to say they've actually come out with less toxic slug baits these days. Here's my favorite control. This is actually copper barrier tape. And if you have container gardens and you put this copper barrier tape around it, it turns out the slugs and snails can't go across it. It's a very thin layer of copper. You know, copper is expensive stuff these days, with an adhesive backing. Copper, I know this from chemistry class in high school, has a very loosely held electron. That's why we use it in copper wire for electricity. And when slugs and snails contact that, they actually get a mild electric shock, enough to discourage them and have them turn
around. Slug electric fence?
Yeah, exactly. It's an electric fence for slugs. And I like this picture because the same people who are now making this also made Corey's slug bait, which was probably the most caustic stuff on our planet. If you ever read the warnings on the package, it was like, do not use this where waterfowl are present, or children, or pets, or running water. It's just like bad news all the way. So I'm glad they're now investing in less caustic alternatives. Okay, here's a better picture of one of those tail droppers. You can actually see the little suture, a little mark, kind of a V-shaped mark right by the tip of its tail. But I really wanted to show this picture, not so much because of a nifty tail, but because a friend sent me this picture. He's saying, is this an albino? Well, it's not. It turns out it's actually, that's the color that this particular species is. But this is my reminder that a lot of times when I give talks like this, I wind up learning a lot from the audience members. You guys know a lot too, and you probably have observed a lot of things as well. So I always encourage people to get a hold of me after a talk like this with their questions or their observations and make it a two-way street, not just me telling you why slugs and snails are wonderful. And the last picture I want to show before we all go off to have escargot for dinner. This is my business card. It has all my contact info on it. So if you want to get in touch with me, just use my name, david@davidgeorgegordon.com, or call me up in Seattle or whatever. But I know you all have interesting things to share about the wonderful world of invertebrates too. So let's make this a two-way street.
Thank you.